This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us for our week in review here on Trumpet Hour. We have our trumpet writers eager and ready to discuss all of the important news of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
From our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
Well, it's been a busy and chaotic time in Washington, D.C. the last week or two, with a lot of people wanting to impeach the president. What for? There are a lot of charges being thrown around. Stephen Flory's been talking about this quite a bit on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this week. It's really receiving an unbelievable amount of coverage here in the United States, so much that it's difficult to tell the real news from the fake news. Stephen Flory has been helping us to navigate these waters. We're going to start our week in review today by giving one of our panelists a chance to do the same, and that is Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, as you pointed out, there is just, I mean, especially in the United States, just so much media saturation that it just really takes quite a long time to just sift through. It's like, well, what actually happened here? And you do kind of have to like back up a year and try to get a broad overview of this to see exactly what is happening and why is it significant. Because this started back June of last year when someone hacked the Democratic National Party's headquarters. The FBI later came out and said they believed it was Russia. That hack exposed some corruption within the higher-ups at the Democratic Party, which allegedly made people less likely to vote for Hillary Clinton during the election, especially like Bernie Sanders supporters and stuff like that. They stayed home, which the Democratic Party is now trying to say that that's why Trump got elected. Could be true, but now you have to see is like, okay, but what's that actually have to do with President Trump's behavior? And so there's been accusations being thrown out for months now that he actually colluded with the Russians to help this happen, even though there's been no evidence presented so far to back up that claim at all. But now with more recently, after they Mr. Trump fired the FBI director, some of those claims have gotten louder, and they appointed a special prosecutor on Wednesday, Robert Mueller, who is a former FBI director, just to kind of hopefully put this issue to rest, to see, just do an independent investigation to see what do we actually know. And he was appointed real shortly after news came of an intelligence leak this week. According to the intelligence leaks, is that Israel had some information on ISIS that they'd passed on to the Trump administration. And then the Trump administration had shared some of that information with the Russian ambassador in the White House last week. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a big like media sensation over the sharing of classified information. And this is something that should point out that actually technically sharing classified information is impossible for a president to do. Because as the leader of the executive branch of government, he's the one who has, he's like the buck stops as to what's classified or not. Whatever he feels comfortable sharing with other nations, that is something that you have the legal right to do. So there has been no, and Trump's owned up that he did give the Russians some information on this city in Syria where ISIS was influential. Don't know exactly what the information was, but in just kind of a collaborative effort to fight against the Islamic State over there. And so from legality, the person who did something wrong in this case, as they point out in an article on Geopolitical Futures this week, is that the fact that the media found out about this means that someone within President Trump's inner circle leaked this information. So they're showing he's having this this showdown with the Democratic Party over these like impeachment or allegations of collusion with the Russians, but he also can't even trust those even with his in his inner circle, is that if he tells information that was classified to a nation that's fighting ISIS, the media is going to find out about it, which is probably the biggest angle from that story is just the fact that, I mean, this is kind of like this civil war almost between the Trump administration and what people are called like the deep state. These are security officials and intelligence officials that keep their job from administration to administration to administration, who keep leaking information like this, which could definitely hurt relations with America's allies around the world. It doesn't look like, from what I've seen, that Israel's making too big a deal out of this. Although I did see an interview with a former German defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, where he was pretty, I'm not going to say upset, but definitely pretty strong on the implications this could have between U.S.-Germany relations. So he said, no, those relations have already gotten a little rocky from an Obama administration scandal when it was revealed that the NSA, the National Security Agency, had tapped Chancellor Merkel's phone. And now, from what this statement Guttenberg said, he says that this is unbelievable. There is a concern that due to Trump's lack of knowledge, well-crafted structures could be at risk. And I don't know if he's assessed that quite right as being this particular scandal being Trump's lack of knowledge as so much as is that people within Trump's circle aren't keeping confidential information confidential. But you could see if you're someone like an ally in Germany or Europe or other things that you'd be somewhat reluctant to share information with the United States that could help us prevent terrorist attacks or help us fight ISIS if they think that this is going to be leaked around the world shortly after they tell us.
Right. And on top of that, just the amount of infighting and chaos that's happening, not only within, you're talking about Trump's inner circle, there being certain insecurity of information there, but the infighting between the administration and the media and the establishment is such that it's just like watching the administration kind of get torn apart here in a way that really, I would think it would give any ally of the United States pause in terms of how much can they even trust this administration? Is it even going to be around? It's hard to know. Well, things looked okay this week, but what's going to happen next week? You know, I would think that question would be on their minds at all times as well. And even just thinking about how much the Donald Trump has added to the confusion by undermining some of the things that the people within his own circle have said, that you're getting contradictory information from this spokesperson versus this tweet that are adding to this. And it's almost like Charles Krauthammer described in his column, how much it's the behavior of someone who is trying to cover up something when there's really nothing to cover up in this particular case.
Right. And there are a lot of Kremlinologists who have actually speculated or heard some pretty good analysis that may have been the reason that the Russians hacked the Democratic National Party headquarters in the first place, if indeed it was them, isn't so much to like install a puppet government or something like that, like the allegations say, but just that by sowing seeds of doubt, they've gotten a lot of bang for their buck if they were trying to destabilize the United States. They allegedly hacked into one political party's headquarters, and then have basically just sat back and watched the American political scene practically tear itself apart over finger pointing on both sides.
Remarkable to watch this happen. We appreciate that, Andrew. We'll move on now. We could talk about that for a lot longer, I'm sure. But efforts to create a unified European military continue to move forward. This week, European Union states cleared the way for a new EU military headquarters to become operational almost right away. It's going to take charge of three military missions in Africa. This came out of a meeting yesterday among EU defense ministers, and it was one of several decisions that they announced. For this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yeah, so on Thursday, they basically put the final approval on this military. We've talked about it before, I think, at an earlier stage while it was going through the negotiation process. And I think back then they agreed to it in principle. And then yesterday it was much more finalized. And now that they've said it will just take kind of a matter of a couple of days, basically, to get it all officially in place. So we're moving pretty quickly. It's going to be set up within the EU head of foreign and security affairs, Federica Mogherini's offices, basically. And and then we'll be up and going, and it will be overseeing those training missions within mostly North Africa and mostly those locations. Now, there were some last minute attempts, it seems, or attempts by Britain to kind of put down more roadblocks or do more to stop this from transforming into a European military. And I think they did end up changing some of the wording. And it says that they agreed on a compromise wording after that. I don't know whether we have the full details of that yet. I think Britain's in quite a tough position because on the one hand, they don't want Europe forming this European army. But on the other hand, they don't want to, they're leaving the European Union. Europe's going to be able to do what it likes in a couple of years anyway. And they don't want to kind of create a whole load of bad will and only end up delaying things by a year or two at best. So they tried to put some stops on this, and but now it looks like they're moving forward.
Well, tell us about the details of the specific missions that they're going to begin with.
Well, it's only overseeing training missions or non. Executive missions. The three training missions at the moment are in the Central African Republic, Mali, and Somalia. So that means it's not involved in combat for now. These are places where, especially Mali, for example, it's the German army training Malian army, and they have forces come and rotate through, and then those forces go out and fight basically local branches of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. They change affiliation. But carry out those missions.
So if these troops were actually to undertake combat missions, this would require permissions of individual member states. But what they're doing right now, this is actually something that can be coordinated independently of individual member states. Is that right?
That's right. And it's a much more streamlined system of coordination. And as we mentioned last time this came up, it's not hard to imagine this. Then just taking one extra step and saying, well, okay, we're going to allow it to coordinate combat missions as well. And as we mentioned then, a lot of nations have said, well, this is what we want it to lead to eventually. This is all we can get people to agree to for now. It's also a good opportunity to get the system tested out and to get the command system up and running. And then it's just a small step to change it to combat missions.
Right. And for those who have been eager to create a unified European military, still, this is quite a big step. I'm sure that they're excited about just seeing this moving forward, where it's actually they're going to be housed in a building. There, you can see this kind of headquarters facility developing here. This meeting of the EU defense ministers, can you tell us what else they agreed to this past week?
Right. There's something else that I think is of more immediate practical significance and probably be lost a bit among the grand headlines about a European military. And that is about EU battle groups. So this was a major step that Europe took several years ago towards an EU military. They agreed to set up these battle groups where you'd have several nations serving under kind of one coordinating or in some cases, I guess, I think that like the Baltics work together to coordinate. And then they'd go and deploy. And the idea was these could be deployed very quickly. Just within a few days' notice, it was a fairly small force. Each battle group is around 1,000 strong. And this would give the European Union a rapid reaction force. So something happens around the world, they've got these forces ready to go. They're in a constant rotation, so somebody's always ready at any time. And boom, they can go, they can deploy, they can get stuff done quickly. That was the theory. In practice, nothing has happened. They've never been deployed. And a big reason for this is the money. Mm-hmm. And that's the change that they made with the EU defense ministers. And it changes everything when it comes to these EU battle groups. It used to be that the host nation would have to pay. So if France has an EU battle group and they deploy, France has to pay. And France is, it's going, well, what's the point of that? If I'm going to pay for it, I might as well just use French troops rather than European troops. And know, it's just simpler and easier that way. And, you know, why should I pay for something that, say, a European goal anyway and doesn't affect me directly?
Mm-hmm.
Now they've changed it. So they actually agreed this. They've talked about it for some time, but it's now officially been agreed that the European Union is going to pay for these. The money instead will come out of the EU budget. And that flips things around completely. Now, say you're France and you're thinking about, okay, we could do with getting involved in this location. Well, now suddenly you're like, well, I could send 1,000 French troops, but if I use an EU battle group, Germany helps pay for it. Finland helps pay for the rest of the whole European Union helps me pay for it. And suddenly, instead of being a less attractive option than your own troops, the EU battle groups become more attractive because it's a way of immediately spreading the load. So I think that could be a very significant development. I mean, it remains to be seen how much will come of it. But I'd be watching very closely to see whether you start getting these EU battle groups actually get used. And that would be then a major step forward for European military integration.
Particularly because when you look at the resources available to the European Union as an entity, as a, you know, the whole conglomeration of European nations that are involved in this project, suddenly you start seeing something closer to parity between European military resources and, say, American resources or Russian resources. When you're looking at individual states, say the amount of military spending that would be available to any single nation would be considerably less. But this really does kind of put the whole project into perspective, and it gives you an idea of just how powerful Europe could be.
Right, and those are two interesting examples because America vastly outspends Russia, and so that shows the other characteristic of that of leadership being so important when it comes to military spending. You've got, you know, if Germany spent 2% of its military of its budget on its military the way America wants, it would have a military budget bigger than Russia's. So if Europe were to get its leadership together and pool all of those resources, fine, it wouldn't have a budget quite as big as the United States, but it would be far bigger than Russia. And you look at what Vladimir Putin's been able to do on Russia's military budget. Think what Europe could do if they have decent leadership and decent integration, which is exactly what we've been, the direction we've saying Europe's been heading in for years.
Well, thanks for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The German military was recently dealt a bit of a blow by Turkey. The Turkish government recently denied German lawmakers access to Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, which is where German forces there operate from. Well, in response to the uncertainty in the relationship with Turkey, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said Germany needs to look elsewhere to establish a military base in the Middle East. And the country she specifically named as a possibility was Jordan. To learn why this is significant, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, so looking at this this tit-for-tat that's gone back between Germany and Turkey for a while, revolving around German troops that are operating out of the Incirlik air base, is interesting because the German politicians have tried to visit their troops a number of times at the air base. They've been denied by the Turkey's government. It happened once again this past week. So Ms. Merkel comes out and says, well, we're going to continue to talk with Turkey about this, but in parallel, we're going to explore other ways of fulfilling our mandate, that mandate being part of their reconnaissance flights in the fight against ISIS. And then she said, quote, that means looking at alternatives to Incirlik, and one alternative among others is Jordan. So she specifically mentioned Jordan in this light, which is interesting because if Germany was to fly out of a Jordanian airbase, that would put German troops even deeper over, I guess, around 500 kilometers, 600 kilometers deeper into the Middle East. So they would have greater access points to the Gulf. Even they would be closer to Iran. They'd be closer to Iraq. Jordan, if you look at it right in the middle on a map of the Middle East, Jordan is right there in the middle. So it's a more strategic location than even Incirlik would be.
The relationship between Germany and Jordan isn't one that we talk about all that much. How strong is this relationship?
It is quite strong. I mean, outside of the United States, Germany is already Jordan's second largest donor to the nation. We've written up probably in the last couple of years the groups or a number of tanks that have been purchased by Jordan from Germany. I think Ursula von der Leyen was in Jordan late last year to hand over these tanks to Jordan. So there is a military relationship there between the two nations. Now it seems it could become even stronger with German troops on the ground. Right now, there's about 250 German troops at the Incirlik Air Base. Those would be transferred over to the Jordanian territory if this goes ahead.
We have an article, I guess, waiting to be published on thetrumpet.com here from Callum Wood that points to why the relationship between Germany and Jordan is one that we're watching at thetrumpet.com. Maybe you can just put this in the context of biblical prophecy for us, Brent.
Well, there's a couple of prophecies that we're looking at in relation to Germany's relationship with Middle Eastern nations. One is the Psalm 83 alliance we've talked about before, Germany allying with different Sunni states in the Middle East. It's interesting, Turkey is one of those that we expect them to stay in a relationship with because Turkey's part of this alliance, and so is Jordan. So we can see that prophecy as well in play. But also there is the prophecy in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40, which talks about these two rival powers, the king of the south, radical Islam led by Iran, plus this unified Europe under Germany's command. And it talks in that verse specifically of a strategy of Germany to actually surround Iran in a whirlwind type strategy. And we've described that, the editor-in-chief has described that in The Whirlwind Strategy, another piece that he's written. And so what we can see is part of that being fulfilled if German troops would be even closer to Iran, even closer to Iraq. We know that they're going to control Iraq, and they're already controlling Iraq right now. The next state over from Iraq is Jordan. So we could see this clash or this coming clash is becoming clearer because the troops are going to be right next door to each other.
This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We'll go now to Asia, another worrying missile test in North Korea this past Sunday. This one quite a significant milestone in North Korea's weapons capability, possibly even its nuclear capacity. For this story, we'll go to our Asia analyst, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on Sunday, North Korea conducted a successful missile test, and at first it looked like a pretty run-of-the-mill, ordinary launch. But as the dust settled from this event, and as more details came available about the specifics of it, it's clear that it actually did mark, as you said, a milestone in North Korea's missile program and possibly also its nuclear program. This missile that they fired was a mid-to-long-range Hwasong-12, and it was launched from a site near the city of Kusong, that's in the western part of North Korea, and it reached an altitude of 1,300 miles and flew about 490 miles before it fell into the Sea of Japan near Russia. So it was fired with a really lofty arch, just going far higher than a missile of this kind normally would, and that was because it was just a test. But experts say that if it had been fired with a usual, more lateral trajectory, instead of flying at such a huge arch like that, then the missile could have traveled about 2,800 miles. And that place is Guam, and the U.S. Anderson Air Force Base there within this missile's range. That in itself wouldn't necessarily be anything new, but after the launch, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that a large-size, heavy nuclear warhead can fit onto the Hwasong-12, and analysts don't dispute that. The rest of Kim's statement was a little bit more middle school-esque, I think, than usual. He said, quote, "If the U.S. awkwardly attempts to provoke the North, it will not escape from the biggest disaster in history." End quote. But anyway, taken all together, this it just means that what initially looked like just another missile launch was actually a landmark event and just an undeniable indication of how quickly the North Korean threat is growing.
We were talking on Wednesday about the relationship between South Korea and North Korea and just how the South Korean president, the new president who was just installed, wants to seek closer relationship or at least to resurrect that sunshine policy with North Korea. How does that affect his plans?
Well, this does mark the first missile test from the North since President Moon in South Korea entered office. And in contrast to U.S. President Donald Trump's emphasis on using pressure tactics against the North, Moon has advocated, as we covered in that program on Wednesday, he's advocated that sunshine policy that expands engagement and dialogue in order to sort of stabilize the peninsula. And so in light of this test, it really puts a bit of pressure on Moon. It forces those questions about whether the U.S. and South Korea will find common ground to just be dealt with a lot more quickly. It adds a lot of urgency into all of those questions. And Moon did issue a pretty sobering statement after this test. He said he believes that there's now a high possibility of military conflict with North Korea. So it could have really stymied his hopes of sort of a return to that sunshine policy.
Thanks, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about American airstrikes in Syria and, in a sense, how Iran is responding, America's dying aluminum industry, China's effort to control world trade, and how the Chinese government is putting pressure on young people to get married. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Yesterday, U.S. warplanes made some airstrikes in Syria against forces believed to be loyal to President Bashar Assad. It was another sign of America's increasing engagement in Syria. And America's presence there is having some interesting ripple effects in the region. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so the strike that America has done in the past against Syrian regime forces is the important one, the Tomahawk cruise missiles that were fired at that airstrip, one of Mr. Trump's wow moments of his presidency because of the gassing of Syrian civilians by Assad. So that was number one. And now what we've had this week is the second attack directly against regime forces. The United States doesn't attack regime forces unless they are provoked. And what we had in southern Syria was some tanks that were heading towards a deconfliction zone in southern Syria, which America uses, and one of America's allies on the ground there, a Sunni Arab group, they use that area. And I guess it's like about 30 kilometers across, where no regime forces are meant to come. No one's meant to come into this zone. Well, the United States told the Syrian regime, don't come into this area. They continue to roll full steam ahead. The Russians told the Syrians, don't go in there. And yet they still went in there. So the United States had an airstrike against them and destroyed some of their forces. We don't know about how many Syrian forces were killed in this attack, but it was a direct attack against Assad's forces, which is a substantial change from what we've seen, again, going back into the Obama years of the Syrian civil war. That never happened, and yet it is starting to happen with Mr. Trump.
It almost seems like it's against his better judgment, or it's against a lot of what he had said in terms of trying to keep America distant from the United States. But like we've talked about, it's whatever your intentions, the fact is that the Middle East does demand considerable attention on the part of the most powerful nation in the world. So it remains to be seen, I guess, how deep America's involvement in Syria would go. But there's another story that came out this week that shows that there's maybe some interesting effects happening within the region as a result of America's presence there.
For sure. And this is taking place actually in northern Syria, the opposite direction of where those airstrikes were. And it was released by The Guardian And they have good sources, I guess, that have alerted to them that the strategy that Iran had, Iran, of course, is the ally and the main benefactor of the Syrian regime. Iran had a strategy of building a roadway or a land corridor that it uses existing roadways, but also creates new roads to help them get from Iraq all the way across to the Mediterranean. And back in March, it was released to The Guardian that they had this strategy, and they were going to have a northern route across, actually close to Turkey's border, and then go down a little bit to the port of Latakia once they got to the coastline. So it came out this week that instead of taking that northern route, they're actually having to build a southern roadway, or changing the course of that pathway to the Mediterranean. And the main reason is, it's because the United States and Turkish forces are pushing into Syria with the fight against the Islamic State, and Iran is deeming it too dangerous now, or it's actually the fact the United States forces are there, it's jeopardizing their long-term plans, and they're going to have to actually move their roadway further south.
So what do you think this means? Is this just Iran trying to protect its interests in the face of, say, a Trump administration that it can't quite predict what he's going to do? How significant of a change is this for Iran? We had talked, we had learned about how it was suspending its nuclear activity, say, back in 2003 when the United States started its incursion into Iraq, that it has proved itself to be responsive to America when America shows force. Is this anything on that level?
I think it is. We've often talked about Syria as kind of been in the bag of Iran and Russia, and yet this is a concrete sign that Syria is still up for grabs. The fact being that Iran can't trust that in the future northern Syria will belong to the Syrian regime, because if they built their roadway and it didn't no longer belong to the Syrian regime, they would not be able to access the Mediterranean. They would be cut off of one of their great long-term plans. So they are cutting their losses right now, even though they've already put a lot of treasure into this idea, and they have decided, well, at least we can be assured of southern Syria remaining in regime forces, the hands of regime forces. And so it shows that the Syrian battlefield is not won just yet by the Syrian regime, even though Russia's fighting for them, even though the Iranians are fighting for them. When the United States and even Turkey comes down from the Turkish border and fights against ISIS, that has ripple effects, and Iran does change their plans militarily.
Very fascinating subject. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Brent. We're going to switch gears here. A foundational pillar of America's military might is its manufacturing. And one strategic resource America needs in order to have that strong manufacturing base is aluminum. Yesterday at thetrumpet.com, we posted an article by Trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau about how America's aluminum industry is dying, and this could have serious strategic implications. For this story, we will turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, he points out in this article, the number of aluminum smelters in the United States has fallen from 23 to only 8 since 2001. Just within the past 2 years, they have 8 smelters closed down, which laid 3,500 people off of their jobs. But as you point out, beyond just like the economic considerations of Americans being laid off from manufacturing positions, aluminum, even though a lot of people don't necessarily realize this when they think about it, is like a strategic natural resource. A lot of the military equipment, a lot of jets, a lot of planes are made from aluminum. And so making sure that you have a steady supply of aluminum and the industrial capacity to smelt it is vital for war efforts. And that's actually the exact reason why these aluminum smelters are closing, is that China realizes just how important aluminum is to war efforts, and they're doing a similar thing with aluminum as they've done with like rare earth minerals that are used in vital electronics, to where they've bought up like rare earth mineral mines and aluminum mines around the world, And then with even within China, they have the government subsidize these industries to where you're basically the people who do this smelting work are getting paid from tax dollars instead of from sales revenues. And by doing this, they're able to actually sell their aluminum and rare earth minerals and other strategic resources so cheap that no Western nation can compete with them. And so these Western nations, they're just closing down and figures like, well, we'll import from China. It's so much cheaper. And for peacetime, okay, they're probably saving quite a bit of money by buying the cheaper aluminum than doing it, than actually producing it domestically. But then the thing is, if you actually get into wartime, you come to a place where you've got a possible rival nation that controls a lot, most of the world's aluminum and rare earth minerals and other strategic reserves.
Yeah, so this is a deliberate strategy by China, and it's one that they've shown in other other areas as well. You mentioned rare earth minerals, but this is really the kind of thing that Donald Trump has been so outspoken about in terms of how China undermines American trade and undermines American interests in the way that it conducts itself. Here, this really does have very important strategic implications. What happens if China decides, well, we're just not going to sell this aluminum anymore?
Right. And you could find yourself in a position where it'd be hard to get a supply. And like I said, there are certain sectors of the economy, rare earth minerals, aluminum probably amongst them, that it does pay to have some government protections on just to protect for national security. But then one of the huge risks overall is President Trump makes a lot of good points about some of these deliberate and even underhanded strategies that China's used in their trade relations with the United States. But you have to remember that some of this this trade imbalance has built up over half of a century. And so, like I said, now you get a place where the aluminum smelters, they're just not here. A lot of others, they're not here. So he's trying to bring them back with tariffs, but the threat with that is that if the tariffs come too high and then China automatically stops selling at all or just cuts back, does retaliatory tariffs back with that, you can come up that you can actually have your supply cut off before you've developed your domestic industry to a point where you're self-sufficient. And that was a huge, that was the biggest strategic threat from trade war, is that if your supplies are cut before you're self-sufficient, then you're in a real problem.
This information, Abraham put this together based on, in part, an article in Foreign Policy called "Cheap Chinese Aluminum is a National Security Threat." And it puts all of this in perspective and just how much this disadvantages the United States in our national security needs and being able to look after our own interests and make sure that we're able to secure our own means of production in our military capacity. Put this in perspective for us prophetically, Andrew. Abraham talks about this somewhat in his article, but the United States, we talked quite a bit about a besiegement taking place and very much at the hands of China. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, for one, actually, if you get our free booklet by Herbert W. Armstrong, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, they've actually got a lot of the last pages of that booklet are just really outlining just prophecies of the decline of America and just showing that in the 1950s, it was actually America that controlled all these strategic resources. And so just that change that now it's not America, but it's China and other nations that do it is tremendously prophetic. But like I said, the verses that Mr. Blondeau highlighted in that article are coming from Isaiah and Ezekiel about like this prophesied trade siege, where God said that if the end time nations of Israel, America, Britain, Judah turn away from His law, that you would have these hostile foreign powers. China being one of them, using its biblical name Kittim, that form this like anti-American alliance. That all working together, you can keep these vital strategic resources from coming into the country at all.
It's quite an interesting situation and a prophecy that we need to keep our eyes on there. We appreciate that, Andrew. It leads right into our next segment. President Trump has talked a lot about how America needs to renegotiate trade deals with other nations. Some view this as America pulling back in its leadership on global trade. So whatever void this might be opening up, there is one nation that seems intent on filling it, and that is China. This week, there was a large conference in Beijing to promote China's new Silk Road, and it reflects China's effort to seize global economic leadership. For this story, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is a trend that we've been watching for some time now, and China has one of their biggest projects to seize global leadership is their new Silk Road project. They plan on spending nearly $1 trillion upgrading infrastructure between China and Europe, all across Asia. And they want to bring in oil from Central Asia into China, but then also create these massive overland trade routes between China and Western Europe. And they're starting to build railway lines now so that you can travel between, say, London or Madrid by rail to China in just 2 or 3 days. And they want to use this as an opportunity just to open up avenues of trade that weren't available before. Because once you can start moving products around within a matter of days instead of 2 or 3 weeks, suddenly you can trade in a whole load more goods that you couldn't really trade in before. And you know, the ease of trade generally increases the volume of trade. So this is it's an important project from the rise of China, but it's an important project from the point of view of cutting America out of the picture, because the Silk Roads, this new Silk Roads, or One Belt, One Road, as it's also called, doesn't include America. It's between Europe and China, but not only that, it also cuts out Chinese dependency on waterways that are controlled by America. And on the one hand, they're shifting a lot of things onto land where the American Navy can't intervene. And then on the other hand, there are still waterways, and water trade is always going to be really important. And so China is concentrating on getting a foothold in some of the key sea gates that it needs to be able to continue to trade with Europe, with building bases in Djibouti, for example, and other projects. So it's a major trade initiative, and it's centered around Europe and China.
So tell us about this conference in particular.
Right. So it was significant for a couple of reasons. One was just how high profile this conference was. You had nearly 30 heads of states, the chief of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the UN. They came along to this. So lots of high profile people. It shows just the stature that this One Belt, One Road initiative is getting. And it got a lot of attention in places where it hasn't gotten from before. But then what I think is also interesting is it showed a divide between China and Europe that we've not seen in this initiative before. Until now, generally these two have worked hand in hand to create an economic system that's not so dependent upon the United States, because they kind of see it as a win-win. You know, if we're moving away from the United States, we both play a more central role, a more important role. However, now that started to diverge. And I think what you're seeing is they're kind of taking it for granted now that we're moving into a post-American world. That's not where they're going to have to put all of their effort. Now they're shifting their effort into making sure each individual side is the one that benefits. Mm-hmm. And so the One Belt, One Road initiative, as it stands, is very China-centric. China's leader Xi Jinping gave a lot of speeches about the importance of free trade, about how it was all meant to criticize Donald Trump, how protectionism is evil and how friendly China is, and free trade and friendliness go hand in hand. And Europe really called them out on that and said, well, look, actually, we're not going to sign up to the trade conclusions of this summit, one of the main conclusions of that summit. And actually, we're not going to send heads of state like a whole bunch of other people have, like we probably would have done in the past. We're going to send some lower level officials, because you talk about free trade, but you don't allow us to trade freely with you. You put all kinds of restrictions on you. You want free trade from us, but you're not prepared to give us free trade with you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's them showing Europe is not going to sign up to some kind of one-sided China-centric arrangement. If there's something that's truly bilateral, if there's something that is a truly free trade zone, something that does put them on an equal footing with China and cuts America out of the picture, I think they'll be all on board with it. But as it stands, the way that they saw this project going was something that was too China-centric for them to sign up to right now.
So they have this conference. They put forward this joint statement. The European Union refuses to sign it. The way that you are describing this is very interesting, the fact that these two parties, giants in trade on the world scene, were united up until this moment, where it seems like we've crossed this threshold beyond which the United States is not going to be a major player. And that's always the way that it works, isn't it? That enemies or disparate parties are able to unify so long as it's against a mutual enemy. But then as soon as that enemy is eliminated, then the differences begin to emerge.
That's right. And that's probably why you'll see some of the more effort to reconcile these differences going forward, is although I think, as you said, we've reached a certain point when it comes to the United States. The United States is still, you know, it's not completely disappeared.
Sure.
And so I think there's enough pressure still there from the United States that they will probably sort over their differences. And I think China will make some compromises, will let Europe in on this much more. Over the past few years, you've seen a lot of people talking about the special relationship, especially between Germany and China. So it's more of a disagreement among friends because of the presence of the United States. And then as we see the United States step back more and more, I think you'll see more and more hostility in that relationship.
Very interesting to watch. I really want to encourage listeners to go to thetrumpet.com. And Richard has an article called Silk Road Summit, Europe and China Compete for Economic Leadership, because it really, not only do you learn the facts of this, as we've talked about here, but it puts it in its context of biblical prophecy. And this economic relationship between Europe and China is something that we've been watching specifically because of a biblical prophecy that talks about this very thing. It's something that longtime trumpet readers would be quite familiar with. But seeing this reach this point in its development really is it's a fascinating juncture in the relationship between these two parties. And as you said, we can expect to see more cohesion, more collusion going forward, and yet there is these underlying tensions that we also would expect to be amplified as well. Thank you very much, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. There are probably a lot of single people who have felt the pressure of someone telling them, you know, you need to get married. It's probably usually parents, maybe friends who are already married. But you don't know pressure until you're actually getting that pressure to marry from the Communist Party of China. For this, we will go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yep. In the last few years in China, more and more adults have started to choose to stay single rather than marrying. And this parallels the trend that we've seen in the Western world for more than a generation now. Just instead of choosing traditional family, more people are focusing on their careers or on education, or just kind of deciding not to enter adulthood for as many decades as possible. And in America and the rest of the West, it looks like there's probably not much in the short term that will really be done to reverse this trend. But China is different. It's an authoritarian government, as you said, and it has no qualms about controlling as many aspects of the lives of its people as possible. And on Wednesday, the Communist Party gave a press conference and basically said, hey, young people, if you don't hurry up and take the initiative on your own to get married, then the Communist Party will step in and see to it that you do. This was actually a conference for the youth division of the Communist Party. It's called China's Communist Youth League. And I'd like to just read through three ways the government said that it will step in and solve this problem. Number one, the government will help the youth establish a correct view of marriage. Number two, the government will carry out events and activities to expand the youth's social circles. Number three, the government will promote matchmaking services. So the government really is serious about getting these young people married. And the initiative here didn't come out of the blue. Actually, back in April, the Communist Party issued a very detailed and pretty Huxleyan sounding plan for Chinese youth. It's called the Medium and Long-Term Plan of Youth Development. And this plan basically says that the government needs to step in and make sure that all Chinese youth have government-sanctioned ideology, government-sanctioned education, and that the government needs to attend to the young people's health, employment, culture, dating, and marriage. And on the last point, marriage, the plan says that the government is working in conjunction with the Chinese media to promote, quote, the civilized, healthy, rational, and positive view of marriage and clearly resist the negative view of marriage, end quote. So it actually sounds in some ways like a helpful and wholesome program. And there may be some positive aspects to this campaign, but still to see a national government controlling and micromanaging so many aspects of the lives of its people is alarming. It's a lot of authority for a political party to take on. And it just shows how powerful and authoritarian the Communist Party in China is becoming.
You mentioned just this anti-family view that has taken over among young people in China. It seems like that's somewhat the case in a lot of nations, and we've seen that in some Asian nations where it's actually contributed to a decline in the population of some of these countries. Is this China's the initiative here is to increase the population?
That's right. That's what's behind it. For the last 30 years, I think until 2014, China had the one-child policy, where families were only allowed to have one child. They abandoned that a couple of years ago and went to a two-child policy in most rural areas anyway, and in a lot of cities as well. So now they're realizing that they have some serious demographic problems, and if the current trends persist, pretty soon they would have a disproportionate number of elderly people and not enough children being born, not enough young people in the workforce to do blue-collar labor and things like that. So, this is happening throughout Europe, just a lot of demographic problems like that. And it's interesting to see governments like Russia. Russia now has a national holiday that basically encourages couples to procreate on that day. And they have some tax incentives that they offer, and it's kind
it's
of interesting
awkward.
If you look into the details of it. Yeah, it's like Valentine's Day times 100, but now China's taking some similar initiatives.
It is interesting to just see the kind of maybe unintended consequences of a policy like the one-child policy, where maybe bureaucrats are aiming to solve one problem and then they end up creating other problems, and here they are trying to rectify the problems that came from the solutions that they used to identify the other problems. Yeah, Andrew.
Right, because that is definitely with the combination of the one-child policy and gender-selective abortions, you've got a situation where you've got like 30 million too many single men in China. So for the single women they have there, it would probably be relatively easy if the government's doing matchmaking services to find someone for them. But for single men, unless you have some sort of huge immigration program, you're not gonna get rid of that problem anytime soon.
Right. And there have been some women in China who are standing up and saying we're not gonna be bullied into marriage.
For educated women in China, marriage is not that enticing in some ways. It's a very male-dominant culture, not to the extreme that we see in the Middle East. But if a woman, you know, becomes very educated, she doesn't necessarily want to rush into this union that will make her quite an inferior to her husband. So, yeah, it's a difficult problem.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio. Visit us online at thetrumpet.com. We've talked about a whole lot of stories that you'll be able to find on thetrumpet.com with links to relevant older stories from our archives and pointing you even to some of our source material. And so we do encourage you to go there and check out what we have on thetrumpet.com. We're going to finish our program next with our lightning round. That's the important news that has caught our attention. That'll be coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
We'll get through as many items as we can in just a few minutes here in our lightning round, and we'll start with Brent.
Iranians voted today in the country's first presidential election since its nuclear deal with world powers. Incumbent President Hassan Rouhani's main challenger is cleric Ebrahim Raisi. He is backed by the religious establishment in Iran. Raisi is a custodian of the Astan Quds Razavi religious charity, which, though it's a charity, it oversees an endowment worth billions of dollars, so he is an important figure. This election is largely viewed as a referendum on Rouhani's policies, which paved the way for the nuclear deal, even though hardliners, it seems, were against that deal. And the big issue on the minds of Iranians is the economic issues, mainly because of the 56 million eligible voters, many of them, most of them, are yet to see any benefits of this nuclear deal, which may mean that they'll come out in force for Raisi. We'll see. The results should be in a few days.
And now to Richard.
The interior ministers of Germany and Italy want a new EU military mission in southern Libya. The Welt am Sonntag reported on Sunday that the two had sent a joint letter to the European Commission saying that the mission is needed as soon as possible. They want to stop migrants traveling from further south of Africa into Libya because then they tend to go from Libya on into Europe. But it's a development that sees Europe being pulled more deeply into North Africa.
And Jeremiah.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has said that China is willing to mend its ties with South Korea. The relationship between Beijing and Seoul became really strained over the last few months after South Korea became the site of America's now operational THAAD system. China hates that the South allowed the U.S. to launch that system, but last week, South Korea elected that new president, and so Mr. Xi in China came out yesterday and said, in light of the new president, China hopes that South Korea and Beijing can become stronger friends.
And over to Andrew.
There may be more atheists in America than previously thought. Past polling results have indicated that about half of Americans believe that God is a person, a third of Americans believe in God as an impersonal force, and about 10% of Americans don't believe in God at all. But by employing a new polling technique designed to keep people's responses anonymous, researchers at the University of Kentucky have produced some compelling evidence that it could be roughly 26% of Americans have serious doubts about the existence of God.
Okay, back to Brent.
Make Israel great again. That's one of the slogans on gigantic posters that are going to greet Mr. Trump when he arrives here in Jerusalem on Monday. While in Jerusalem, Mr. Trump is set to become the first serving president to visit the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall. He's also set to visit Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas for the second time this month as he works to produce a Palestinian-Israeli peace deal. And in an interview published today in Israel Hayom, he said, quote, "I hope that this can happen quicker than anyone has ever imagined." So he's very positive that he could make this deal happen. And even though he does seem like he is very pro-Israel, there is a collective nervousness right now in Israel that Mr. Trump is going to push them too hard, push the Israelis to make some really hard and tough concessions if he wants to get his peace deal through.
And Richard.
The new French president was sworn in on Sunday, and the very next day he made his very first foreign trip of his presidency. The location really for France was a no-brainer, Germany, but I think it shows the importance of the power Germany has within Europe that's what he does on day two of his presidency. He met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel and he talked about his new vision for Europe, what he wants to be done with Europe. And Germany's so dominant in Europe that the Franco-German partnership is going to be something very important to keep watching.
And now to Jeremiah.
Russia has stepped up its support for North Korea in order to constrain the United States. So in spite of international sanctions that are in place against North Korea, Russia has been increasing its fuel exports to Pyongyang, and this is filling in the supply gap that was created a few months ago when China halted its trade with the North. And really, this couldn't come at a worse time. With China finally agreeing to help the U.S. to really apply pressure on the North, it looked like the North was struggling and possibly willing to make some concessions, but then here comes Russia ready to fill in the gap.
And we'll conclude with Andrew.
Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark said in an interview on Wednesday that he has taken a job as an assistant secretary with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. According to this interview, Sheriff Clark will start the new position this June. His appointment has raised some controversy, surprisingly, in that Sheriff Clark has gone on record in the past as blaming government welfare programs for making his fellow black Americans in inner cities dependent on the state, and blame family breakdown of the nuclear family for exacerbating criminal behavior in inner cities.
Thanks for that. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about on today's Week in Review program. You can email us your feedback at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Epictetus: freedom is not procured by a full enjoyment of what is desired, but by controlling the desire. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.